RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Eric Crampton is the Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative, and Eric joined us last here at RCR, well, on this program anyway, back in November. Then we were talking about soaring council debt levels. That probably hasn't abated around the nation, and what that meant for ratepayer and community assets. And Eric is joining us again, this time to talk about the government's new housing policy and maybe the latest bill in the media space. Eric, thanks for coming back to RCR. It's nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, this new housing policy, first, from your point of view, the legacy policy, what was wrong with that?
Okay. Labor had made a lot of progress under its urban growth agenda in enabling a lot more density. Cities need to be able to grow up and out if we want to get housing costs back in line. So for a couple of decades, we really had not enough building. That was largely because councils were not zoning enough land, whether up or out, to respond to increasing demand. That meant that there was only one area for flex, and that was prices. We had overcrowding and pushing up rents, pushing up land prices and house prices. Auckland's unitary plan allowed more building. Labor's urban growth agenda allowed a lot more density. Coming into the election, National was a little concerned about the medium density residential standards. They didn't like the compulsion in that. They previously had bipartisan agreement for it. ACT had kind of opposed, and National was taking a lot of pressure on it, it seemed. So they pulled back from some of those rules, but with a caveat. National is as committed as Labor was to getting housing back under control. They see the massive inequities that are caused when, like, people like me who bought houses when it was somewhat more reasonable, we're locked in. My kids are going to have a much harder time. And there's a lot of harms from that. So they want a lot more housing growth. Backing down on the medium density rules would tighten supply compared to where it otherwise might have been. And they've been trying to think through ways to deal with that. So what they've come up with overall, it'll depend a little bit on the finessing in how it's done, but it looks good. So one big improvement over what Labor had is we are going to be enabling more subdivisions. Cities need to have both. If you have only density and you don't allow new subdivisions, you're still going to have inflated land prices in town. It's great that you'll be able to get lots of apartment towers, but land within town is going to be far more expensive than it needs to be because bare paddocks at the edge of town can't compete with them to turn into new subdivisions. Right. National is going to be fixing that. They are requiring the councils put up in a hurry the next 30 years worth of land supply rather than dribbling it out in three-year increments. If they want to opt out of the medium density rules, councils will have to put up plans showing that they're serious about it, that they have credibly put up 30 years worth of supply. Quite how that's going to be checked, I think that's still in flux. That will matter. You'll expect that councils will try and game that a bit, and you would hope that central government will be watching closely on it. At the same time, they've made other changes that are pretty neat. So they've gotten rid of some pretty costly rules for apartments. So in Auckland, for example, they've had balcony requirements and minimum apartment size requirements, things that go above and beyond what the Building Act requires. So people often forget this. The Building Act specifies what's necessary for a safe building. Councils sometimes layer on top of that additional requirements. The National Party's announced proposals will not be adjusting the Building Act, but will rather be telling councils, don't go above what the Building Act requires in terms of minimum floor sizes and apartment standards, balcony requirements. Those requirements add an awful lot of cost for apartments. None of these require that people wind up living in small apartments. Rather, it enables them to happen if that's what people want, right? So there'll be a lower cost point. Also, really encouragingly, and this hadn't been in Labor's agenda, it's not that they wouldn't have gotten to it, but they hadn't yet. They're going to be requiring that councils enable a lot more mixed-use development within all of the areas that are subject to the National Policy Statement on Urban Development, so all of the places that have to have at least 6 stories as minimum height requirements. That matters for some competition aspects. So if you look back to the Commerce Commission's market studies on groceries, they found that one of the big problems was that there just aren't enough spaces that are zoned for new grocery stores. requiring that councils enable like metro supermarkets below apartment towers, that'll really start opening things up. And you could start imagining folks like Aldi coming in and saying, great, now we can come in and start offering more competition, which would be really super. It'd be great. That was really restricted before. That's going to open up. Another neat bit is that they're opening up small retail more generally. So Minister Bishop had signaled that as sort of a guiding principle, all tier one and tier two cities are going to have to allow like small corner dairies and cafes basically everywhere. So that enables people to start little businesses that they otherwise would have been constrained against running. So that's also really good. The work that's yet unfinished. The underlying problem has been that councils see growth as a cost, that they face most of the costs of enabling growth. Central government gets most of the benefit. And so that's led to this mismatch of incentives and restrictive zoning. Central government still needs to ease things up to help councils bear the cost of growth with better financing options. Some of that is being solved through water system reforms. Some of it is yet in progress. The ACT Party coalition agreement with National had had incentive payments to councils. So I think it was an amount roughly equivalent to the GST from new builds would be rebated back to councils so that they, to help them in defraying some of the costs that they experience or find ways of greasing the wheels to make things work. That hasn't yet been announced. They're presumably still working on it, but it was in the coalition agreement. Something along those lines will yet be coming, and that'll further fix it. It'll make it less likely that councils will be trying to game the 30-year supply rules.
Yeah. You're sounding quite enthusiastic, I have to say. Do you think they've thought this through well? I'm picking up that you think that.
Well, it's all in line with good urban economics, right? So underlying all of this is a supply problem. And the supply problem is caused by councils not having zoned enough land. Labor had agreed on this as part of their urban growth agenda. National's going for housing growth is on the same line. We've got generalized bipartisan consensus on this. We're starting to see some movement on some of the underlying constraints that are driving council decisions like this and recognizing them. So that's also really encouraging. And Minister Bishop really seems to have staked a lot on this, that this is his one big thing for his term as minister. He wants to crack it.
Yeah, I saw a statement from him saying it was kind of his mission in what he's doing there.
Yep.
That dribbling out of land and the infrastructure costs falling on council, is that why land availability was kind of minimized? Because every time you allocate new land, that's just more expenditure on ratepayers in the end, isn't it?
But we're stuck in this terrible problem where councils that are up near their debt limit have to be able to really quickly start collecting rates on land that they're servicing with new infrastructure. And one of the ways that you do that is by making sure that there's always a lot of new demand that comes up whenever you, or a lot of new development that comes up when you zone new land. And that kind of requires that there be a shortage. So if a council is at or near its debt limit, effectively it has to pay off the cost of any new infrastructure kit within 3 years rather than like a 30-year lifespan, which doesn't make a lot of sense. The coming changes to water company structures, like we've already seen progressing in Auckland and should roll out elsewhere, that'll free things up a bit. The cost of water infrastructure have been one of the binding constraints that have made councils reluctant to enable more extension. Minister Bishop's guiding principle here seems to be that new developments should be allowed whenever they can actually wash their face and cover their own cost, but with the tools that let them do this. So it's not a cost falling on other ratepayers. It's a cost that's going to fall on the new developments and the residents of the new development over time as they enjoy the benefits of that infrastructure. So that's really a sensible principle for going ahead with it, because otherwise you're stuck in these up and out fights where people in town who love density, they look at the higher cost of providing infrastructure at the edges of town and they say, oh my God, sprawl is costly. It means my rates bill is higher. Let's ban new subdivisions. And then they tie in other weird stuff around carbon that's already covered in the ETS. That works to help block growth. We need to enable both, and enabling it really requires that the beneficiaries cover the costs that they're otherwise imposing on others.
With these changes taking effect, with your expertise as an economist, how long before the effect becomes obvious and felt, do you think?
That's a tougher one. So it's going to take a while for these plan changes to work through in like new city plans. Wellington's already got its plan through, and that's great. Auckland looks like they might delay a little bit. I'm not sure what's going to happen in Christchurch, although problems in Christchurch are smaller than elsewhere. You won't really see an effect on rents until the supply is there. You could see an effect on prices before the effect on rent is there because people anticipate things, right? So if you expect that a coming flood of supply will mean that rents will be lower in 10 years' time than they otherwise would have been, you should be willing to pay an awful lot less right now for an investment property because it's that flow of rents that determines capital value, right? All of it's muddled up by sharp changes in interest rates and inflation rates that will make it harder to discern a price signal out of there. And it makes me really wish that New Zealand had something that they have in the United States, which are the Case-Shiller markets. But I'll just briefly explain what those are and why I wish we had them. So in the United States, you can go for every major metropolitan housing market and look at basically a stock market index that's based on the house price in that city. You can look at that over the next 10 years, and you can short it if you think that house prices are going to be going up by a lot in one city or down by a lot in another city. You can make bets on that through the futures market. In New Zealand, it's really hard to short housing. If you think that the supply changes are credible and that house prices are going to be taking a much shallower path or maybe even declining, or at least land prices should decline, house prices should decline, land prices will vary a bit, you should be able to short those kinds of indexes, but there's no real ability to do that. I own one house. I find myself dangerously overexposed to the housing market in Wellington. It's a shaky place. One house in Wellington's it's an uncomfortably large portion of our family's wealth. I would love to be able to sell half my house, but that's not really going to work, right? If you could short the housing market, then you'd have a much quicker signal of investors' expectations about what's going to be happening in house prices. And that'd be really neat. I'd love to see like Treasury and the Reserve Bank getting together to facilitate those kinds of markets, because it'd be really helpful for the Reserve Bank in setting monetary policy as well to start seeing the market's expectations of the effect of what it's doing on different housing markets.
Yeah. Do these changes, or do you think these changes will spur developers and you know the construction industry into some sort of new stage of activity? Will that give them the right cues, do you think?
I think there's a lot of win in it. So one first effect is that if you are currently sitting on land that is zoned for development and you had expected otherwise that you weren't going to be having many competitors for a similar land, maybe you were holding off, wanting to dribble it out, you're probably going to want to get that out in a hurry before house prices start dropping with the flood of construction activity. Getting in ahead of that is probably good, although everything right now is depressed because of overall economic conditions. More interestingly, there's been really neat work done in the United States looking at the effect of tight zoning regulations and weird rules like apartment sizes in Auckland and whatnot, and balcony requirements on the productivity of the construction sector. So if the only kind of building that's allowed, because like councils are really restrictive and they only allow a little bit of building and to like rules that vary between one city and another, it's hard to get economies of scale and scope in building, because you can't just put up the same apartment tower in lots of different cities. You can't, the same footprint of a house might not work in different places because of varying rules. And even if all of those were identical, you have a hard time scaling up, because if only the next couple of years of land is going to be allowed and you don't know what's going to be coming afterwards, like do you hire a big construction crew or just a tiny one? Getting a flood of land onto the market all at the same time and stopping councils from putting in bespoke rules over and above what's required by the Building Act means that builders can start doing standard form template stuff. So an apartment building that is good for Christchurch will be good for Auckland, will be good for wherever, right? If you move in that direction, you get a lot more efficiencies in construction. And the American work showed, they were expecting something like a 90% increase in construction sector productivity if you could get rid of all of those dumb rules that they have in the U.S. If we get rid of them here, we might see gains also in construction sector productivity that you might otherwise not have been banking on, just because it's really second order. It's down the line from like the things we see every day.
So more could go into this from your view, the ability to short that market and what you've just said now. But overall, what sort of mark would you give this policy, these changes?
Okay. It'll be hard to, you can only give a provisional grade because the final grade would depend on how they wind up sorting the rules on assessing 30-year plans and determining the amount of housing that's enabled by them, whether they're able to get infrastructure funding and financing rights so that councils are able to get that through, and incentive payments down to councils. As a provisional grade, it's an A, but it's just provisional. There's still work to be done. And we'll see what the final form winds up looking like.
Okay, while we've got you, before you go, your view on the news or media digital bargaining bill, how positive are you about that?
Can you give an F minus?
Okay, says it all.
So it's just so damn depressing. And you wonder whether Minister Goldsmith has really thought through the hell that he's going to be bringing on himself. So in Canada, after they passed similar legislation, Facebook exited. The general principle on this was that, Facebook is stealing from media companies somehow by linking to them and then driving traffic to those sites where they see ads on the news sites page instead of on Facebook's page. Facebook said rather than deal with any of that, they were just going to stop allowing news. Once they did that, a whole pile of small independent operators were in deep trouble because they lost tons of ad revenue. So they went begging to the government for a bigger media subsidy. So Canada had a scheme in place where they would rebate this journalism tax credit. So 25% of qualifying wage bill for a media company got rebated back to the media company as a tax credit. They're looking to boost that to 33 or 35%. I'll have to double check back to a higher cap. So effectively, they're going to be subsidizing up to like 20 grand worth per journalist as a subsidy to the media companies, so long as you meet the government's guidelines of what counts as a media company. And then you get all of the concerns that people have about whether government is being right or not in how it decides who gets the money. So there's all of those problems. Quickly after this legislation passes here, Meta will exit as they did in Canada, because why the hell would you stay? Australia has been looking at have been wondering whether they need to set legislation that would force Meta to keep serving up news, which seems weird if you think that Meta was stealing from the news companies.
Well, that's like a gun to the head, isn't it? That's a gun to the head.
The whole thing has been a gun to the head. It's been a shakedown racket from day one. Like, they call it bargaining, but it's bargaining where if the media company and the platform don't come to an agreement, an independent arbitrator comes in and decides which final offer is they consider to be best. And nobody has any clue what that offer would look like, right? And that's one of the reasons that Meta pulled out. In Canada, they said, we have no clue how big a fine we could be liable for if we let anybody on our site link to news. We aren't going to have a bar of it, right? Like, why would you face that risk for something that actually is kind of a cost for you, right? Because it drives people off your site.
Yeah.
So we'll have that problem here. It's nonsense as tax policy. Like, there can be a case, like people argue about the extent to which government funding of media drives bad outcomes or whether government has sway over it. But there can be a public interest case around encouraging more journalism. But to the extent that there is, you want to fund it out of general tax revenue. You don't go and shake down some other industry to pay for that industry. It's a terrible way of setting tax policy. It makes me a little angry.
Isn't it a fundamental distortion of how free market works? Because, well, first of all, why should any media company be protected in this way? And that includes us. And we do what we have to do, you know, to survive in this market. And it's changing. And we're setting some of that change. It's sad that some are going to fall by the wayside, but I can tell you that there'll be plenty more new startups to take advantage of the playing field that exists after that. And I'm also wondering, get your view on this. Isn't the government having it both ways? They're throwing a bone to MSM. They know, like you just told us about the Canada situation, possibly Australia, and it would be repeated anywhere that this kind of idea was being implemented, that the platforms will walk away. The government will say, well, we tried, sorry. And, you know, the inevitability of what's happening continues.
Yeah, it's really predictable what's going to happen out of this. And I almost feel bad for Minister Goldsmith, because after this passes, he's going to have some small independent operators just knocking on his door saying, look, your legislation is killing us. You have to do something to provide support. He'll have to come up with something at that point, because it'll be entirely Minister Goldsmith's fault for having done this. National was sensible about it before the election, and that's one reason that perhaps they didn't get as much advice as they should have at Select Committee. So if you'll recall, at first reading, Melissa Lee was calling it a shakedown racket. Okay.
And she disappeared.
Yeah. Well, you kind of wonder whether a PM that just wants ministers to get stuff done, but is less across the details, wasn't satisfied that there hadn't been anything done yet, when there isn't really anything that's easily done in that space. So anyways, election happened. Submissions were due early November on the bill, but it looked like it was just dead in the water, right? Because National said that they opposed it and that it was a shakedown racket. Why would you waste time submitting against something that they're not going to do when there's a billion other things on? Instead, they just heard from the big media companies pleading for shaking down the tech companies. It's pretty stink. It will put a stink on tech sector investment in New Zealand overall, because we're a less reliable place. If we're the kind of place that will shake down the tech industry whenever some set of locals starts complaining, like why send money here?
I could go to anyone on the street, I think, Eric, and say, okay, here's what they're proposing. And, you know, the big platforms have to pay to carry the news. The news is clicked through from the platforms. The news outlet gets the benefit and traffic of that. And if they're forced to pay for that news, what do you think will happen? They'll say immediately, well, of course, if I was the platform, I'd cut them off immediately. I mean, it's so blinking obvious, you know?
Well, Meta did that. Google hasn't. So in Canada, Google has had this Google Showcase program where they provide a lot of support for journalists and training and stuff like that. As part of their bargain under Canada's bargaining framework, I guess it is to avoid being put under the bargaining, because the authorities can designate. So they shifted from having Google's funding this news showcase, which was them working directly with journalism teams and media companies, to dumping money into a government fund. And now those media companies can go and apply for money out of that government fund instead.
Yeah.
But it may be that big a win.
It may be of interest to someone or an entity the size of Google to sort of smooth the waters at almost a diplomatic level, right? Because they're so all encompassing and everywhere and so big that they can possibly afford to do that, or have other needs that they want to maintain.
Now they're very different companies. They take different tax on it. It'll be depressing to watch how things play out here.
All right, Eric, thanks for your time. Eric Crampton, Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative. Good to talk with you again. And let's see what other people say about these housing changes. Yeah.
Great stuff. Thank you.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.